You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Spring 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Daisy Shaw Ellis and Jose Criales Unzueta write on style, send nudes. In the photos, Dua Lipa in Chanel, Dakota Johnson in Gucci, Kristen Stewart in The New Arrivals, Margot Robbie in Armani Privé, Charlie XCX in Dallara Fincoklu, Chapel Roan in Mueller, Tiana Taylor in Schiaparelli, Lily Allen and Colleen Allen, Jennifer Lawrence in Givenchy by Sarah Burton, Hailey Bieber in Saint Laurent, Jessie Buckley in Maison Margiela Artisanal, Zoe Kravitz in Saint Laurent, Lisa in Enfant Riche de Premier. As the runways suggest and the red carpets confirm, so-called naked dressing is here to stay. Consider Margot Robbie's skimpy Wuthering Heights press tour, full of sartorial hits, and Chapel Roan's mischievous Mueller dress at the Grammys, a diaphanous chiffon slip hanging from her nipples, which was a recreation of a 1998 couture design by Thierry Mueller that appeared dated when put back on the runway in September, before Roan breathed it new life. Many moons ago, fashion in polite society was guided by primness. Consider the rule of thirds. The gist is that one should divide the body in thirds to choose where to emphasize. A blueprint for flattering proportions and a suggestion applied to what or not to reveal. That's gone out of the window. We now wear clothes that reveal as much as they conceal. Whatever happened to the art of the tease? We've gladly moved on from politeness, but why not opt for tantalizing sensuality versus sexuality? See Teyana Taylor winning a Golden Globe in a cheeky Schiaparelli dress, awards ceremony in the front, after party in the back, the new principle of dressing, according to designers and celebrities alike, is the rule of none. On to foreign affairs, Team America. President Trump has deployed his lackeys, bootlickers, and fawners worldwide, resulting in a diplomatic orbit fit for the New World Disorder. Aidan McLaughlin has the rules to a game where a handshake is the only prerequisite for the job. Illustrator Javier Munoz drew the maps and the caricatures. Herschel Walker, the famed NFL running back, made his first foray into politics in 2021 when he ran for the Senate in Georgia, narrowly losing in 2022 after his campaign was derailed by his rampant conspiracy theories and an allegation he pressured a woman to have an abortion, which Walker denies. Charles Kushner, father of Jared, is yet another diplomat who benefited from clemency. Trump pardoned him for his 2005 conviction for illegal campaign contributions, tax evasion, and witness tampering, which doesn't sound so bad unless you recall that witness tampering refers to when he hired a sex worker to sleep with his brother-in-law so he could use footage of the encounter to retaliate against his sister for cooperating with the government in a federal case. Callista Gingrich, the perpetually face-tuned wife of Newt Gingrich, has decamped from the Vatican, where she was stationed during Trump's first term, to Bern, where she continues to post online about her fabulous life as a diplomat. Tilman Fertitta, Trump's man in Italy, is a billionaire restaurateur whose empire spans from Bubba Gump Shrimp Company and Rainforest Cafe to the Houston Rockets and New York hotspots like the Corner Store and Keen's Steakhouse. In Rome, Fertitta spent the start of his tenure living on a yacht parked on the Med and commuting to work by helicopter while the ambassador's mansion was being renovated. Dan Newlin, nominee. If you've ever driven through Orlando, you will recognize Newlin's name plastered across billboards promoting his services as a personal injury lawyer. The former deputy sheriff was, as of recently, a major donor to Democrats until he went all in on Trump. And voila, a nomination to serve as ambassador to Colombia. Kimberly Guilfoyle. Soon after Guilfoyle broke up with Donald Trump Jr., Trump announced that he was dispatching her to Athens, where she has since made a splash as ambassador to Greece. Should it come as a surprise, however, that this former assistant district attorney, ex-wife of Gavin Newsom, and one-time Fox News star has impressed in the cradle of Western civilization? David Perdue, Trump's refusal to concede the 2020 election and insistence the race was rigged are often blamed for sabotaging Perdue's own campaign for Senate in Georgia that year by depressing Republican turnout. So it seems only fair that Trump would tap Perdue for a prime posting in Beijing. Tom Barrack, the wealthy businessman and longtime Trump ally, has been a brash force in the region, fielding complaints from some Republican lawmakers and pro-Israel groups as he advocates for a closer relationship between Washington and Ankara. Mike Huckabee, the evangelical pastor, erstwhile Fox News host, and unlikely bass player, is a fanatical supporter of Israel to the extent that he regularly attacks its critics, from the Irish government to church leaders in Jerusalem. His fervor has even caused controversy among Trump's base. Earlier this year, Huckabee met secretly with a man who spent decades in American prison for spying for Israel. Elbrint Bozell III. This far-right activist has no discernible connections to South Africa, aside from opposing the African National Congress and once criticizing Nelson Mandela, making it unclear why he was tapped for this role. Beyond the plum gig, Trump has been good to Bozell. His son, who was sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison for January 6th, got a presidential pardon. Thank you. Power lunch, salad days. If New York has pizza, then Los Angeles has salads. And as you might expect in this town, even the greens have a hierarchy. Let us examine the offerings by Elise Taylor. Illustrator Lauren Tamaki did the restaurant illustrations. Polo Lounge, McCarthy Salad. Ingredients, lettuce, chicken, beets, egg, cheddar, avocado, tomato, and bacon with balsamic vinaigrette. Price, $46. Leafy Lore, named after Neil McCarthy, the longtime entertainment lawyer to Ginger Rogers and Joan Crawford. The McCarthy Salad has been in the Polo Lounge menu since 1948. You are a former studio head. You live in Truesdell Estates. You wear head to toe, Bruno Cucinelli. Your name drop, Bob Evans. La Scala, chopped salad. Ingredients, lettuce, salami, mozzarella, and garbanzo beans with Leon dressing. Price, $20.95. Leafy Lore, La Scala claims to have invented the chopped salad back in the 1950s and introduced it to the likes of Judy Garland and Marilyn Monroe. You are an aging power agent. You live in the flats. You wear James Purse. You name drop Ari Emanuel. All time, good ass salad. Ingredients, greens in season, fruit, lemon dressing. Price, $22 plus $6 for avocado. Leafy Lore made the infatuations Instagram. You are a curator / consultant / jewelry designer who secretly lives off your finance dad's credit card. You live in Silver Lake. You wear a slicked back bun and micro sunglasses that you saw on Hailey Bieber. You name drop Rachel Sennett. Erewhon, salmon sweet potato detox bowl. Ingredients, Faro Island salmon, sweet potato, red cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, carrots, almonds, and sunflower seeds with apple cider vinegar. Price, $19.50. Leafy Lore, its macrobiotic proportions and properties helped propel Erewhon's revenue per square foot to four times that of the average grocery store. You are a micro-influencer who films your workout classes. You live in West Hollywood. You wear a matching aloe yoga set that, along with this salad, put you into credit card debt. You name drop Tracy Anderson. Health Nut, Noodlerama. Ingredients, chicken, rice, noodles, carrots, cucumber, and pickled ginger with spicy Asian dressing. Price, $14.45. Leafy Lore, the Kardashians love this place so much that Kris Jenner became a minority investor. You are a real estate agent with a $32 million listing that just won't sell. You live in Calabasas. You wear Louboutin and a Cartier love bracelet. You name drop your neighbor Chloe. Jones on 3rd, Chinese chicken salad. Ingredients, iceberg lettuce, wonton strips, and rice sticks, also known as crispies, and breaded chicken with a honey soy dressing. Price, $16.25. Leafy Lore, Jones founder Joan McNamara began making the salad back in 1986 for her daughter's elementary school in Los Angeles, 12 years before her gourmet grocery store opened on West 3rd Street. You are, well, not anymore, but your six-month stint in the CAA mailroom was enough. You live in a Brentwood mom who crossed the 405 for this. You wear Jenny Kane's cocoon cardigan. You name drop Nancy Myers. Now this from Ta-Nehisi Coates, The Homeland. Renee Good and Alex Pretty were labeled domestic terrorists. Rhetoric employed by the Trump administration to justify the state taking life by associating the dead with national villainy. Opening illustration, Life and Liberty. The DHS posted American Progress by John Gast, writing, "A heritage to be proud of, a homeland worth defending." And it shows an interesting-looking Westward Ho-type scenario with indigenous first peoples, settlers, stagecoaches, trains, wagon trains, cattle, pastures, mountains, prairies, bridges, rivers, with a woman in the sky wearing white robes, seemingly stringing telephone wire. In the wake of poet and writer Renee Good's killing, Donald Trump and his collaborators have done all they can to define her as an enemy of the homeland. The administration claims, for instance, that Good was a domestic terrorist, a term it applied to Alex Pretty, the ICU nurse whom federal agents killed less than 3 weeks later. This rhetoric is employed to justify the state taking life by associating the dead with national villainy. But the campaign against Good is different, because the Homeland takes particular and perverse interest in women deemed insufficiently reverent of hearth and home. Trump propagandists tell us that Good was part of a growing cabal of insolent white ladies turned violent, that she was a lesbian agitator in league with 68 IQ Somali scammers, or that she was simply, as her killer apparently labeled her, an effing bitch. For these and other sins, her castigation has extended into the afterlife. With Elon Musk's AI tool, Grok, users turned out deepfakes of Good with bullets in her head and of her corpse in a bikini. This is all inappropriate. In defending the undocumented, Good violated the sanctity of the homeland, which is to say that she questioned the divine promise of American soil to a mythical and singular people. For the homeland is not the state or even the country. The homeland is not defined by simple geography. It exists beyond laws and norms. It is unconcerned with traditional American concepts like liberty, freedom, or pluralism. The homeland is that piece of earth providentially deeded to the Volk. The homeland's borders are drawn in untainted blood, its sanctity exemplified in proper gender conduct and the fulfillment of gender roles. It is the homeland that ICE venerates in its recruitment post, festooned with victorious white settlers and vanquished indigenous Americans. It is the homeland that Musk saluted twice at Trump's inauguration. It is the homeland that the late Charlie Kirk was fond of invoking. "I want to be able to get married, buy a home, have kids, allow them to ride their bike till the sun goes down, send them to a good school, have a low-crime neighborhood, not to have my friends be taught the lesbian, gay, transgender garbage in their school, while also not having them have to hear the Muslim call to prayer 5 times a day. It is often said that the homeland is skeptical of immigrants. But more precisely, the homeland is skeptical of aliens. Asylum seekers from Gaza fleeing a genocide have no place in the homeland. Afrikaners suffering the indignity of post-apartheid are welcome. The homeland is covetous of Northern Europeans, but regards Somali Americans as garbage. Why can't we have some people from Norway, Sweden, just a few?" Trump recently said. "But we always take people from Somalia, places that are a disaster, right? Filthy, dirty, disgusting, ridden with crime." The criteria for these distinctions between putative immigrant and indelible alien are not complicated, for above all, the homeland is a racist project. Securing the homeland is the central feature of the Trump administration. In Los Angeles and Chicago, Trump seeks to cleanse it. With Greenland and Venezuela, Trump seeks to expand and enrich it. Heterosexual men are the rightful defenders of the homeland. Lesbian agitators, such as Good, are its nemesis. Christians are the lifeblood of the homeland. Stupid Muslims are its cancer. A characteristic of the homeland is that its foes must be subhuman. Members of the LGBTQ plus community are freaks, disagreeable women are ugly pigs, and the residents of D.C. are cockroaches. For years, a certain kind of liberal has either minimized such culture war rhetoric coming from the other side or urged political actors of all stripes to ignore it in favor of material or kitchen table issues. As though the state regarding one's life as garbage has no tangible consequence, as if the terms of a fight can be determined by the person getting punched. But Trump has clarified an inconvenient fact. The culture war is an actual war. ICE, full of myrmidons of the homeland, enjoys an $85 billion budget, a sum larger than the annual military budget of every country in the world except the United States and China, as Caitlin Dickerson reported in The Atlantic. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, just one component of the Department of Homeland Security, is getting more money than any other law enforcement agency in America. Deportations are up under Trump, but that is not the true purpose of ICE. They're not serious about getting rid of as many people as they can. They're serious about causing human pain and suffering, a former ICE official told Dickerson. Putting someone into detention isn't a removal, it's a punishment. 32 people died in ICE's custody in 2025, the highest number in 20 years. And befitting an administration filled with reality TV stars, a policy of human pain and suffering is presently being repackaged as spectacle. Activists arrested in defiance of the homeland have had their portraits altered via AI. Minor celebrities, their dubious status on the wane, have sought to supercharge their prospects by accompanying ICE on raids or even joining its ranks. Kristi Noem, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, posed in front of a group of immigrants sent to a torture site in El Salvador in a show of sadistic titillation. Last June, L.A. County Supervisor Janice Hahn watched as Noem led an ICE raid in Huntington Park. "I could tell she was doing a full camera crew production," Hahn said. "She was getting hair and makeup done." Noem, like the president she serves, has a flair for the theatrical. She cosplays in camouflage and bulletproof vest. The focus on appearance and production value is essential in a movement that seeks not just to purify the actual America, but to resurrect the America of legend and myth. Securing the homeland, they tell us, is an existential priority. It is also content. Many Americans, horrified by the Homeland's agents rampaging through whole communities, seizing children, perp-walking half-naked old men, and detaining whomever they feel like, with or without charges, all while enjoying absolute immunity, have settled on an interesting term, occupation. This designation is as correct as it is unoriginal, a fact more Americans would do well to remember. ICE has contracted surveillance tools that, according to Joseph Cox at 404 Media, allow it to track phones without a warrant and follow their owners home or to their employer. These tools, reportedly deployed across Minneapolis, were not created in America, but in Israel, still another homeland enforcing the longest occupation in modern history. Thus, the people of Minnesota have, as American taxpayers, subsidized an occupation overseas that is effectively a laboratory for their own. We did not blindly stumble into this era of homeland rule. Almost 25 years ago, when the Department of Homeland Security was first proposed, there were inklings, even among supporters, that things might someday come to this. Homeland isn't really an American word, Peggy Noonan wrote in the Wall Street Journal in 2002. She supported the formation of the department, but something bothered her about the name. It's not something we used to say, or say now. It has a vaguely Teutonic ring. We must help the Führer protect the homeland. Blogger Mickey Kaus, writing for Slate that year, echoed Noonan's concerns, noting that the proposed department name explicitly ties our sentiments to the land, not to our ideas. Russell Feingold, who was the junior Wisconsin senator at the time, saw something more substantive at work. Feingold saw gaps in the legislation that a would-be tyrant could easily exploit. A figure like that would be completely lacking in virtue. And Feingold's colleagues could not imagine that the American people, in their infinite wisdom, would allow such an arch-villain to ascend to the presidency. People said, "Russ, no president would do X, Y, or Z," Feingold recently told me. In other words, the norms are strong enough that you're just sort of a Cassandra. Feingold was the lone Senate vote against the Patriot Act, and one of only 9 senators to oppose the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. Feingold watched with alarm as, in the wake of 9/11, the country's immigration policy was subsumed by counterterrorism. As soon as 9/11 occurred, within seconds, it became clear that the Bush administration was going to target Muslim and Arab Americans, Feingold said. Indeed, over a period of months, the FBI detained 762 undocumented immigrants, mostly from Muslim or Arab countries, as persons of interest. The Department of Justice's Office of the Inspector General later reported that detainment could result from something as simple as a landlord reporting suspicious activity by an Arab tenant, or possession of suspicious items, such as pictures of the World Trade Center and other famous buildings. These men were held for weeks or months, with some denied contact with legal representatives, some physically abused, and some put on 23-hour lockdown. Most were deported, and despite being investigated in the wake of 9/11, none were ever charged with anything related to terrorism. In 2008, after Barack Obama won the Democratic primary, Feingold began to see another, older trend emerge, one that is foundational to the homeland mythos. While in the Senate, Feingold made a point to hold town meetings in all 72 of Wisconsin's counties. The meetings were, by his telling, pretty mellow, filled with supporters and few conservatives. They were always civil, Feingold said. And then Obama is elected, and I start going to these last 15 or so town meetings, and it was unbelievable. The guy wasn't even sworn in yet. And all of a sudden, all these people started coming, a kind of tough-looking crowd, and booing and saying, "He's a socialist, he wasn't born in the United States, he's going to do this, he's going to do that." And there was fire in their eyes, and it was very strange, because Obama had won many of these counties in the rural areas. And yet there was this thing that was happening. When pundits later tried to chalk up the growth of the Tea Party, then Trump's first election, to economic anxiety and a snubbed working class, Feingold was skeptical. There was this whole dynamic that coalesced into this sort of feeling of white people being under siege, Feingold said. That, to me, is sort of the political context that opens the door. But skeptical as he was, Feingold never saw things advancing this far. He lost his 2010 re-election bid to Republican Ron Johnson, a Trump ally who remains in office and has blamed Goods and Preddy's deaths on Democrats' incitement of violence and obstruction against federal law enforcement. I'll be the first to admit, the reason I did it was because I feared that someday there could be somebody who would do some of these things in an abusive way, Feingold said of his vote against the DHS. But I never imagined that there would be somebody who would do all of these things at every opportunity. Next photos, national anthem. A right-wing demonstrator confronts protesters in Minneapolis. ICE detains a Nicaraguan man in St. Paul. Federal agents at a private residence. Makeshift memorials emerge to honor Renee Good and Alex Preddy. Border Patrol agents in Minneapolis. Civil rights activist Viola Liuzzo, who was killed by a member of the Ku Klux Klan in 1965. The problem will almost certainly outlive Trump's presidency. ISIS budget has steadily increased through Democratic and Republican administrations. That funding has gone to what journalist Radley Balko calls the most rogue, renegade, and certainly pro-Trump police agency in the federal government. No matter who wins the midterms this year or the presidential election in 2028, the Army of the Homeland will remain, and its enemies in the Democratic Party seem to have little desire to fight back. And so then, it falls to the people themselves. In these moments, I find comfort and inspiration in ancestors and martyrs. More than half a century ago, as the writer Jelani Cobb recently noted, activist Viola Liuzzo, a housewife and mother of five, left her family in Detroit and headed south to join the march to Montgomery, and in the process left the privileges of white ladyhood behind. For transgressing against the homeland of that era, the neo-Confederate South, Liuzzo was murdered by white supremacists. Just as Good was slandered by the homeland's authorities as a domestic terrorist and an effing bitch, Liuzzo was slandered by the homeland's rulers as a heroin addict, a nymphomaniac who'd gone south to make a cuckold of her husband. But the slander was itself revelatory, for it demonstrated the homeland's perverse, exacting norms, its obsession with hierarchy, its rigid borders, and the high price levied on anyone who dared cross them. Forces of the neo-Confederate South did not simply represent a threat to African Americans, as was the popular perception, Cobb wrote. They were a mortal danger to anyone who disagreed with them, regardless of the person's race, background, or gender. Perhaps we are in such a moment now, where a death demonstrates to the contrary the broad nature of the threat. But this is a passive hope, and in Liuzzo's life, we find a more active call to action. Liuzzo was born into poverty. Her father was a coal miner, her husband a union organizer. Hers was the kind of salt-of-the-earth family often celebrated in the anthems of the homeland. Whereas the homeland sees freedom as the sole prerogative of its tribe, Liuzzo's vision extended to humanity itself. While understanding the economic exploitation of her family, she also understood that whiteness had enrolled her in the exploitation of others. When Liuzzo acquired this knowledge, when she got woke, she was transfigured into a traitor to her race and a menace to the homeland. For being a menace, for being woke, she was killed, as was Renee Good, as was Alex Preddy. But revelations have their blessings, too. In this case, a life, however brief, that is clean and does not depend on the oppression and debasement of others. The revelation of deep human ties. The belief that we are all equally chosen. Doomed Liuzzo, Good, and Preddy, as revelation so often does. But it also immortalized them.
Thank you.
Now here's the spring 2026 cover story, Dream Big, from a reality show childhood to a billion-dollar beauty business, motherhood to the Met Gala. The youngest member of the Kardashian-Jenner family speaks to Nate Freeman about the playbook on navigating fame and fortune and the public relationships she inherited from the other famous women in her family. As she goes full Hollywood, making cameos in movies, working the award show circuit, and walking the red carpets, will she keep to the script? Photographer Mert Alas contributed to this article. Kylie Jenner is the preeminent attention economy tycoon of our times. She has more followers on one platform than the population of the United States. On an evening last November, Kylie Jenner was out late at her mother Kris Jenner's 70th birthday party held at the Warner Estate in Beverly Hills, which is owned by Jeff Bezos. When she returned with friends to her own house, about a five-minute drive away, Kylie decided to post a reel to her Instagram captioned, "Sharing is not caring when you're drunk at 2 a.m. after a party." It's a pretty straightforward bit of cinema verite. Kylie's friends were seemingly tipsy and hungry and arguing over a bag of the Good Crisp Company original potato chips, crinkle cut. "No, and I said before, you can only have one, and I've already given you three," Kylie said, brandishing the chip bag as a shield against her best friend, Anastasia Stas Karinakolio, who was lunging toward her and the bag of chips. "Why wouldn't you share, Kylie?" This video racked up nearly 65 million views. Let me offer some comparisons. The video of Charlie Kirk's memorial posted on his Instagram got just over 28 million views. The month The Atlantic posted its firsthand account of administration officials sending classified communiques, its entire website got 30 million visits. The three-hour episode of the Joe Rogan Experience featuring Donald Trump, which has been cited as the reason he recaptured the presidency, has more than 61 million views on YouTube. And all that pales in comparison to Kylie and her fellow inebriated, incredibly attractive friends arguing over a $5 bag of chips. We're well past the point where it's shocking to be famous for being famous. That's kind of the primary mode of fame at this point. But Kylie has harnessed the power of metafame in the age of social media better than anyone. In addition to her day job as the head of a viral lip gloss empire, her side gig as a reality television superstar, being a mom to two kids under 10, and maintaining a relationship with the hottest movie star of their generation, Kylie is the preeminent attention economy tycoon of our times. Which puts Kylie in pole position within what's perhaps the world's most culturally omnipresent and media-savvy family of the last 20 years. The crown for most popular family member has been passed among the Kardashian-Jenner clan at various points over the years. Kim Kardashian is a generational icon with more global name recognition than almost any living human and can be almost wholly credited with creating a new reality TV paradigm. Kourtney Kardashian-Barker and Khloe Kardashian presaged the mainstreaming of the modern wellness movement when they forswore refined sugar and hopped on alkaline water. Kendall Jenner recaptured the 1990s cultural fascination with supermodels and has become the highest paid one on earth. They each had their year on the throne. Now Kylie has followed in Kim's footprint to forge the biggest online fan base in the family and lodged herself firmly into household name, center of culture stardom. She has more followers on one platform than the population of the United States of America. In her canonically competitive family, it's unquestionably Kylie's turn. She was always, she still is, so good at social media. She's so good at connecting with an audience, and she knows what the people that love her and follow her want, says Kendall, her older sister. But the influencer landscape is getting debased and splintered and a bit draining, even for Kylie. It's harder to grasp people's attention because there's so much out there. They might see my perfume ad, and then the next 30 minutes, they're seeing all these other ads, she tells me in January. Everyone kind of has a brand now. At the ripe old age of 28, Kylie has embodied the 21st century life cycle better than anyone alive. She was a student of the new internet, then a savant-level creator of the content it craves, then leader of an army of followers who anticipate her every drop. She's both a product of the influencerdom and its most perfect avatar. And now she's ready to tackle something else. She's taking her mastery of new media and applying it to another platform, a more classic form of screen, the big screen. Kylie's going to Tinseltown. What does it mean for someone who's been in the public eye since she was 10 years old to be having a moment? For Kylie, who's been famous far beyond her entire adult life, it's walking into a movie theater and seeing herself. When we met on a sunny January day, a New Yorker's dream of Los Angeles in winter, the Hollywood premiere of the moment, Charlie XCX's bizarro Brat Summer mockumentary, where Kylie makes a brief but memorable cameo, was 2 days away. The first movie premiere that I'm in, I'm thrilled, I'm really thrilled, she says. This is the most excited I've been for the red carpet. Usually I'm not, she trails off for a second. I feel like there's so much pressure, but I'm so excited to be there. It was a career move that shocked some of the people around her. Her social media panopticon is already in so many ways bigger than the 600 movie theaters that an independent film might play in. I remember Kylie mentioning that she was interested in acting, and I wasn't sure if she was being totally serious or not, says Aidan Zamiri, the director of the moment and a friend of Kylie's, who also works with her boyfriend, the actor Timothy Chalamet, on some of his viral social media spots. Her expressing interest in being in our film, that's crazy. Her role speaks to where Kylie is in 2026, what her relationships to the culture has become. She's playing an over-the-top version of the incredibly famous Kylie Jenner, who, while relaxing at a high-end spa in Ibiza, bumps into an over-the-top version of the hard-partying pop star Charlie XCX, who is in a debilitating funk. She doesn't know if she can maintain the whole brat thing and is convinced she'll eventually lose all relevancy, the thing she's fought so hard to achieve. And without a shred of self-doubt, the most relevant woman on earth issues this soul-crushing diktat to Charlie. The second you think people are getting sick of you, that's when you have to go even harder. It struck me as soon as I saw it. Oh, Kylie gets it. In fact, she came up with the entire scene herself. I kind of presented the idea, actually, to Aidan as a joke, Kylie says. I was like, well, if you want me to be in it, I would love to. I felt like it was a comfortable avenue for me because I knew him, I know Charlie, and I felt like for my first thing, this would be the perfect fit. They came back, and Charlie was really excited. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print-impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org, or you can ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.